you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me for this Shazamorific episode, if you made up that word, is from the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, Michael Lane. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am thrilled to be here. This, right out of the gate, this became one of my favorite podcasts, so I am very excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is terrific. Yeah, this is we're talking about Famous First Edition number F4. I don't know why they gave them these weird numbers. F4, which is a reprint of Wiz Comics number 1/2. We'll get into that in a little bit in a moment, which is, of course, the first appearance of Captain Marvel. And before we get into all that, I just want to give a brief history of what the Famous First Editions were for anybody who doesn't know. DC ran a brief series from 1974 through 1975, and then one-off in 1978, where they did Treasury editions of some of their most famous comics from the Golden Age. And the whole notion was they were perfect reprints of these books with the ads, everything exactly as they would have appeared, except they were at a Treasury size. So they did Action Comics number 1, All-Star Comics number 3, Sensation Comics number 1, Batman number 1, Detective 27, and then they did Wiz Comics number 2, because this was only a couple of years after they purchased Captain Marvel from... Well, it's a couple of years after that, and then it would only been a year or two that they started publishing Shazam / Captain Marvel comics. So this is their big reprint edition of this first appearance of Captain Marvel. So, Michael, like, what's so special about this book to you?
Oh, it's a couple things. One is, well, I love Captain Marvel. I just love the character. I've always loved it. I didn't even collect superhero comics until I was about 11 years old. But as a little kid, I loved superheroes. And it was based on what I would see on TV and movies and cartoons. And where I lived, they would rerun Shazam. And so Captain Marvel was one of the first heroes I grew to know. And when you're that age, you don't know, like, production values, what's prime time, what's Saturday morning.
If they're on the TV,
they're one of the big guns. So... for me, Shazam was up there with Wonder Woman and Superman and Batman and the Hulk, because on where I live, they reran him Sunday morning, so I got to know him. So I had, and also my dad was a big Captain Marvel fan as a kid, so, and he told me that early on, so that added a certain level of interest to that character. So long before I ever got into comics, I liked Captain Marvel. Also, I always was fascinated by the fact that they even did these comics. I mean, this was a time where they didn't reprint old comics. I think the only example was the DC had the from the 30s to the 70s books of some of their characters. And they would in their 80-page or, 100-page giants do reprints of Golden Age. But you couldn't go back and get there were no archives. You couldn't get, like, the original, stories of these characters. So I've always been kind of fascinated. These are one of the first examples that they're trying to go back and archive the original stories of the characters DC owned. So I always kind of got a kick out of that. Now, what did kids in the 70s think when they got these? I don't know. I mean, yeah. I could see, given the sort of crude sort of art style compared to what they're used to, I don't know what they thought of it. But I just, as someone who's always been interested in the history of comics, I just kind of found these volumes fascinating that they would do this. And I think it's one of the very first examples of comic books really trying to go back and reprint and archive their earlier, eras.
Yeah, no, I loved the Shazam TV show. I watched it when it aired originally in the 70s, and I loved it. And yeah, like you, I mean, I always thought of him as one of the big guns because he was on TV, and he was on a lot of the merchandise back when I was sort of doing the Aquaman shrine regularly. I had an ongoing feature called My Grudge with Shazam, because it was always talking about how Aquaman got bumped off of merchandise in favor of Captain Marvel in the 70s. Now, I mean, it makes sense because Captain Marvel was on a TV show. I mean, he was a big, big name. But yeah, it always sort of bothered me because it was like, you know, I would see these ads for DC Comics beach towels. You can get Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Shazam. Like, oh, I want an Aquaman beach towel, damn it, you know? So in terms of your reaction about what you thought kids of the 70s thought about this artwork, I can tell you, because I lived through that. I remember having one of these famous first editions of Flash Comics number 1, which reprints the 1940s Flash comics. I remember my mom buying that for me in a mall. And, it's like I just accepted it. Kind of like what you said about there's no notion of, like, daytime or nighttime TV. It's all just TV. I just accepted, like, that's what this artwork looked like. You know, I'm sure I had my favorites, but I just kind of was like, it's all comics. It's all good. And so, yeah, this was really, you know, the beginning stages of where comic book companies were dipping into their archives. We keep using that word. But, like, you know, the whole idea that their past was something worth celebrating, was something worth preserving, that was a fairly new notion in the 70s. And these famous first editions, they didn't last long. I said they only did eight different famous – or nine, actually, famous first editions, and then the series ended. So they did. It obviously wasn't a huge hit because they didn't go much past that. But at the same time, I don't even think they were really aimed at kids, because on top of doing the regular famous first editions, DC also put out hardcover editions of the famous first editions. And
I saw that on your website. I had no idea that there were hardcover versions.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really aimed at like a collector. You know, it's someone that wants to put this on a bookshelf and keep it for posterity. Yeah, it was funny. Many, many years ago, I worked at a Borders Books, and we had access to used bookstores through our inventory system where we could actually order out-of-print books. And I remembered one day, I don't even remember where I got this idea, but I was like, oh, I wonder if any of these hardcover famous first editions are still available. And I found a bookseller that had them. And I was like, well, hell, I'm buying these, because whoever was selling them clearly didn't have an idea for how much they were worth. So I ended up getting copies of every one of the hardcovers for like $10 a pop. And
what year was that?
It was mid-2000s.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I found it, because I would like queue up. I was like, Flash Comics famous first edition hardcover, and it would say like in stock. I was like, oh my God. So I ended up buying on, so that's how I ended up having hardcovers of every one. Now the only one, we're kind of getting off the subject here, but when else we could talk about the famous first editions, at least for a while, is there is supposedly is a famous first edition hardcover edition of Batman number 1, but it's never been found. Even like the price guides are skeptical that it exists. It's never been seen on eBay. So I don't think they ever actually did it for whatever reason, Batman number 1. But all the rest of them are done in hardcover, because I have it. I have a hardcover edition of famous first number 4 of Wiz Comics. So yeah, it's a weird, weird idea.
I'm impressed you got those, but I also hate you because I'm so jealous that
I apologize.
You thought to do that and scored those. That is amazing. Very, I would. Yeah. Killed to have done that and gotten those issues.
Yeah, I just couldn't. When I stumbled on them, I was like, I got to order these before anybody gets wise, because these are going to be gone soon. And so that's how I have them all. It's really very strange. But anyway, let's talk
thing I do want to mention is, I was always. Did you notice when you were growing up and you would see price guides like Overstreet, they would always have a warning, and they would always tell people that be careful because there were dealers that would remove the covers and try to sell these as the original issue.
Yes.
To buyers. Yes. And that's actually how I found out that these even existed, because I was, as a teenager or in my 20s, I would get those price guides. And when I would look up Action Comics 1, it would have a little in parentheses, oh, beware, because, you know, people, there's these things exist and people will remove the covers and they will sell them. And apparently that's actually still a thing today.
Yep, it is.
To get new people. And that kind of, and on the one hand, it's like it blows my mind. But on the other hand, I can kind of understand it, because if you caught me early on in my collecting and tried to, you know, pull the wool over my eyes, I could see falling for that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether it's a dealer that just doesn't know anything, or it's an unscrupulous dealer. Probably the latter at this point, because there's so much documentation of these things. But yeah, people would... The whole idea of these books was that they are perfect reprints in every way, down to the indicia, down to the ads, except that they're giant size. But if you don't know that the comics weren't originally this size, it looks like a vintage comic to you. It's got the price on it. It's got everything. So, yeah, a lot of people would remove the outer Famous First Edition cover and then try and pass the book off as an original. In fact, I get emails every so often from just random people who see my site, treasurycomics.com, and they all have a question about these books. Most of the time it's, hey, I have a cat pee stained copy of Marvel Treasury number 6. Is it worth anything? You know, like, no, it isn't. But every so often someone will write me and say, I have a vintage comic. It's a giant size, you know, Detective number 27. I think, isn't this worth a lot of money? And I'm like, if it's giant size, it's not the real book. And I hate to have to tell them that, but that's the, and you know, they'll say some dealer wants this, you know, or I bought it off a dealer for like $1,000. Did I pay too much? Like, yeah, you did. Cause it's without the cover, it's worth about $5. So it still goes on. And it's funny, we're sort of tying into the Wiz Comics, and that the Wiz Comics cover has a missing element to it on the Famous First Edition. This is not a perfect reprint. If you look on the original cover to Wiz Comics number 2, it says Gangway for Captain Marvel on it. It does not say that on the Famous First Edition. They had to remove it because DC and Marvel had that lawsuit where Marvel had the rights to have their Captain Marvel, and the sort of deal they struck was you can still call DC could still call Shazam Captain Marvel, but not on the cover. They couldn't call him on the cover. So they had to remove it for the Famous First Edition. So even though the whole selling point of these Famous First Editions is that they are exact reprints, even this one is not an exact reprint.
It's the bane of Captain Marvel's existence for like 40 years.
Yep. He can't even be called by his name. And now if they ever do the movie, they can't even call him out of the movie. He's going to be called Shazam. So, well, yeah.
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
Okay, all right, we don't want to go down that road. We only have so much time. So, yeah, so this is Wiz Comics number 2. It was as Famous First Edition number 4. It was on sale July 2nd, 1974. It features a bunch of different features. Of course, Captain Marvel is the cover feature, but it also introduces Ibis the Invincible, Golden Arrow, Spy Smasher, Scoop Smith, Lance O'Casey, and Dan Dare. They love the alliteration here in comic books. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through some brief synopses of these stories, and then Michael and I will talk about them. Obviously, we're going to spend most of our time talking about Captain Marvel, but there's some other things worth mentioning of the other characters as well. So the Captain Marvel story is by Bill Parker and C.C. Beck. Basically, it's the origin of Captain Marvel. His first mission is to stop the mad Dr. Savannah from disrupting the city's radio system. Billy Batson overhears two of the Phantom Scientist's goons and learns Savannah is holed up in a swanky apartment building in the heart of the city. Billy turns into Captain Marvel and he foils the plot and at the same time finagles a job at a local radio station as a radio announcer, and he's going to go on his career as Captain Marvel. I didn't go over the origin because everybody knows it at this point. It's one of the great origins in all of comics. I really think it's a tremendous origin. So like Michael, like, what do you think about this story? What was your reaction to it when you like read it for the first time and seeing,
well,
you know, this original version?
I can't just judge it on the story, but I have to judge it on the whole concept of the character. And it's one of those things that someone would have eventually thought of it, but the first person to think of it is kind of inherently a genius.
Yep.
And what I mean by that is this is about, you know, a year and a half or so after Superman premiered. Superheroes are just premiering dozens a month for like 2 years. It's a huge market. It's exploding. But this is the one where they decide. And again, those comics are primarily targeted towards about 8 to 13-year-olds, I would guess. I mean, I can't say for sure, but that's my impression. This is a kid's market, little kid market. And I know we hear a teenager. I'm sure teenagers read it. We've heard stories about soldiers in World War II reading comics and getting them. But the market they're targeting is about, I'd say, 8 to 13. And for that first group to think of, all right, we're going to have a kid who turns into the superhero. It seems so simple to us now, like 80 years later, but it's genius if you look at the time to be the first company to put that idea forth. And there's a couple of reasons. One, it gives the kids who are reading the opportunity to live vicariously through this grown-up hero. But also think about how we were as kids. You know, we all wanted to be grown up. You know, that's what we wanted when we were kids. We saw the grown ups had power. Oh, I could eat ice cream all night long if I wanted to. No one could stop me. I could stay up all night and watch TV. You know, that's how we thought of things as kids. So as young readers, to have this comic where we could become the superhero. I mean, putting aside the actual story elements of this, that basic idea itself is hugely appealing. And just from that alone, you could see why in the Golden Age, Captain Marvel would go on to be the biggest superhero in comic books for a while.
Yeah, he ultimately outsold Superman. I mean, it's the ultimate wish fulfillment, is that with just the saying of a word, you can turn into a superhero. I mean, it's such an elegant origin. It's so simple. He doesn't have to have some complicated piece of equipment or, you know, put on a suit. He can just say that one word, and boom, he turns into this powerful superhero. And the design, I mean, one of the things is the design of Captain Marvel with his epaulets and the side-swept cape, the color scheme, the blue, the red, yellow, and white. It's just really beautiful. And this, I mean, the Captain Marvel feature would, of course, go on to be drawn by C.C. Beck later on, and where his style would develop, and then Kurt Schaffenberger. So this early story doesn't look a lot like what you think about Captain Marvel, but there's a simplicity to it that's almost like Alex Toth-like, and in some panels, Billy Batson kind of looks like Tintin, which is these little dots for eyes. And like the train that comes to pick Billy up in the subway as this Art Deco design. It's really startling. It's a really beautiful looking feature. I mean, and so again, you're right. Kids of the 70s and the 80s are like, this is so simplistic looking. I don't know if they necessarily get a handle on it, but to me, it's really pleasurable to look at. It's just so, it's just everything reduced to its minimum, to its minimum amount of lines. And watching Captain Marvel smash, throw the goons into the radio, in the radio equipment. And it's just, and then the one full panel where he turns back into Billy Batson is just a lightning bolt. It's just, it really is really quite beautiful to look at. And as you said, they were the first guys to come up with it, Bill Parker and C.C. Beck, and Pete Costanza. These were the guys that came up with it first. So therefore they're geniuses. Cause yeah, this idea was truly a $1 million idea.
One thing that's interesting about the story is this represents actually some Captain Marvel stories throughout the Golden Age, is there's such a weird mix of, you know, whimsical fantasy with kind of darkness. And what I mean is you have kind of the design of the train that you mentioned. You have the seven deadly sins in the hallway.
I love those statues, the seven deadly sins. It's just a great visual.
You also have like that scene, and people joke about it now, that this mysterious figure comes out and is like telling Billy, follow me into this dark tunnel.
Yeah.
And in our minds go to horrible places. But if you read the story, it's meant to be ominous. I mean, that character is basically dark, mysterious, ordering Billy. And these stories, a lot of people, because Captain Marvel's reputation in the Golden Age is being very whimsical and humorous, people don't realize that there was actually a lot of darkness in Captain Marvel stories. You know, people died fairly regularly in these. They could go at the, snap of a finger from, funny talky-tawny being there to some character getting killed and back and forth. And part of it was cultural. It was kind of different. I mean, even kids' stories there could have that. You know, we kind of forget that a lot of those fairy tales and Disney movies used to be fairly dark 100 or so years ago. So there was kind of a weird mix of, it's lighthearted in some parts, fantasy, but it could have some dark moments. It really bounces back and forth. And that aspect actually would carry Captain Marvel, many, many years into the future. You would stay with these lighthearted, whimsical stories, but they would inject these moments of really kind of darkness into them.
Yeah, and this first story after, because he never actually meets Savannah face-to-face. Savannah is radioing in from a remote location, so they actually don't meet. But near the end of the story, Captain Marvel says to Savannah, yes, Savannah, we will meet again. And when we do, you will be behind prison walls or dead. So right then and there, he's like, if I ever meet you, I'm just going to crush you into little bits, you little worm. And it's like, wow, that's a pretty, pretty gutsy kind of thing. And, a lot of people, I think, forget this part of the legend, is that Captain Marvel is sort of got like a phantom thing going, where the whole reason Billy is commissioned into being Captain Marvel is because Shazam needs a replacement. Shazam is about to die. He's very, very old, and he needs to train a replacement. And that is the whole idea behind Captain Marvel, is that there's going to be this succession of them. And so, you've got this old man Shazam, and of course he's a magical creature, so death means something a little different than it does in sort of our reality. But again, right there, we see him get crushed by the giant rock that's above him, because this whole notion is, these guys don't all live forever. And so that's kind of a dark element. So yeah, it's and Billy leads a hard life. He's an orphan. Like, you know, he doesn't have a family. He's out selling papers. He needs a job. I mean, it's, you know, this is 1941. The Depression is less than a decade in the past in America. America's still going through all that. So it has all those elements that you're talking about. Plus, it just has the beautiful bright colors. I love the way the strip is colored. Some panels are just solid blue background, solid green, solid red, solid yellow. Like, it's got this primal simplicity that I could see why this thing, you know, of all the Superman imitators, and there were so many, as you referred to, Captain Marvel is the only one that in some ways surpassed Superman. And it's unfortunate that because he grew so popular, DC felt the need to defeat Captain Marvel the only way they could, which was in a court of law.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned, too, about kind of Billy being an orphan, that's another part I always loved about his origin is, and they built on this later, I'm adding stuff here from what I know about his subsequent history, but the idea that Billy, you know, despite all he's been through, he's an orphan, he's working to support himself at such a young age, he has no one to care for him, it's his innocence and his, you know, good heart that makes the Wizard select him to be Captain Marvel. And to trust him with that power, knowing that he would, you know, he has that potential to be a hero from what he's seen. That's an aspect of Captain Marvel I've always really loved as well.
Have you guys done, I can't recall, have you guys done any episodes on Captain Marvel on Comics in the Golden Age?
It was actually one of our first ones that we covered his origin. I want to say it's like our third or fourth episode.
Okay.
And then I had a few, well, we do our 1 hour kind of regular episodes where we cover a major character or genre. And so, and then I have occasional mini episodes,
right,
like 15 minutes. And I have done a few mini episodes on Captain Marvel stories. So we basically done one big episode, and then we had a few mini episodes here and there covering different stories as well. Because Captain Marvel, he is one of my top five kind of comic book heroes. And if you ask me on any given day, that order would kind of change. Mm-hmm. But he's always up there near the top. And I always liked that idea that the Wizard would pick this young kid who, despite all his adversity in life, has been, you know, blessed with this power and this trust by the Wizard to take up his mantle. It's very appealing. And I think little kids they found that something to connect with.
You know? Yeah, it was a huge seller. And obviously, Alex Ross is a huge fan, because as we talked about on a previous episode of Treasury Cast, you know, Alex Ross handpicked Captain Marvel / Shazam to be one of the characters who got his own large-size Treasury painted book back when they were doing them in their late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, that was Alex Ross just simply having the commercial heft to get that done. DC would not normally pick Captain Marvel to do a kind of a big-ticket book like that.
I did really like the Treasury, and I liked your episode recently when you covered that.
Yeah, that's my favorite of the ones that they did. And that's saying something, because I like them all. So now,
I do have to ask, as the guy who does film and water as well, do you know who Savannah and Captain Marvel's designs are based on?
Captain Marvel is, I thought I read a combination of Fred McMurray and Tyrone Power. Those are the two that I've heard. I see more Tyrone Power than I see Fred McMurray, but I've heard both. Savannah? No, I'm not. Who's the model? And what poor real human is the basis for Savannah?
I've always heard Max Schreck, the original Nosferatu.
Wow, oh, okay. I could see that. Sure.
I don't think you necessarily see it later if you flash forward 5 or 6 years, but this original story, I actually think you can see it more there.
Okay. Yeah, I buy that. Yeah, because you're right. Later on, we had the big buck teeth and stuff, and they turned him into more of a comical character with the kids. He ends up having Beautifa and Savannah, the two kids and stuff like that. It's a weird. It's a whole evil family, which, you know, I guess you could. Never mind. I was going to make a joke. Okay. is there anything else we want to say about Captain Marvel before we move on to the other stories?
Just one point I did want to make is I can understand kind of, again, kids that age, you know, generations on reading this, and because the art style is fairly crude, not necessarily feeling the urge, oh, I'm glad I like Captain Marvel, I'm glad I know his origin, but I don't really feel the urge to read other Golden Age stories. But this story, particularly art, is not necessarily, as much as I love it, it's not really that representative of Golden Age Captain Marvel.
Right.
And what I mean is, In the first year and a half or so after this, C.C. Beck's art style would evolve tremendously. And Captain Marvel had become much beefier. He would lose that sort of Captain Kirk chest lapel thing he's got going on. His mannerisms become more childlike. And Bill Parker, the creator and writer of this, he wrote almost all the Wiz stories for like the first 15 or 16 issues or so. And then he would join the army. And when he got out, he went back to the magazine division of Fawcett. He would not go back to comics. And they did some other writers, but pretty soon Otto Bender, the subsequent DC artist or DC writer, he came in and he basically was the head writer on Captain Marvel. And he just created an entire universe. He added that whimsical sort of lighthearted element to the Captain Marvel stories. It's very different than this story and what Bill Parker was doing. Bill Parker was a solid writer, but it was very by the numbers kind of stories. There were a few really good adventure stories, but Otto Bender came in and did the really what would become the Captain Marvel style that exploded with young readers. So if anyone, even if you read this and you wouldn't necessarily want to go back and, you know, read more Captain Marvel, I would at least jump a year or two ahead to like 1943, give a few of the stories a shot. And just as a quick example, you know, Otto Bender, when he was writing for DC in the 60s, he co-created, you know, Supergirl, The Phantom Zone, Brainiac, Bottle City of Kandor, Lucy Lane, Beppo the Super Monkey, Titano the Super 8, the Elastic Lad identity for Jimmy Olsen. This writer, when he was working for Fawcett in the 40s, he created Murray Marvel, Uncle Dudley, Talkie Tawny, Mr. Mind, Black Adam. He did a huge amount of work. And he said he worked with the editors for story ideas. He worked with C.C. Beck. But one of the same head writers for Superman in the 50s and 60s, who created this huge universe, did the same thing for Captain Marvel. He basically, you know, Marvelized the Superman world in a lot of ways. And not to take away from the other writers and artists, but you could tell if you compare. I mean, basically the same guy who created Mary Marvel co-created Supergirl. So that alone tells you kind of the influence. So I would say that even if you read this and you look at the art and the writing and you don't feel like you necessarily have an urge to check out Captain Marvel stories, if you have any attachment to the character, I would still go back and maybe, you know, jump a year or two ahead, give some of those stories a shot, because he evolves tremendously in that time. And it's a large part of that has to do with Otto Bender's contributions to the character.
Very interesting. Wasn't there a series of stories in the 50s where it's Shazam versus the Monster Society of Evil that like ran through several comics, and then like,
yeah, I think it was actually in the 40s, and it was the first serialized story. I may be wrong, don't quote me on it, okay. But I'm pretty sure it was still in the 40s, and it went over 20 issues, because these were anthologies. They each had like multiple stories, and I think it was in Captain Marvel Adventures, where in each issue Captain Marvel would have three or four stories, and then one or two other characters would. And there was a serialized story where it stretched over like 20 parts, I think. And it was the one that introduced Mr. Mind. And he basically organized these villains. And you didn't even... Mr. Mind had not existed before. You know, the little worm Mr. Mind. And he didn't even reveal who he was. He was just the mastermind. And then I think about the fifth or sixth chapter in, I'm not sure exactly, you finally learned who this, you know, the mastermind. And it was this little tiny worm from Venus. But apparently it was hugely popular, because I read an interview with Otto Bender where he was talking about how surprised they were that this, when they revealed four or five chapters in that this little worm was responsible, how many letters they got from kids who loved it. So they actually ended up extending the serial even further beyond that, just because it had been received so well. And Fawcett early on had more crossovers and continued stories than a lot of Golden Age comics. Like even, I think by the 15th issue of Wiz, they had Spy Smasher and Captain Marvel had a crossover that lasted like three issues, which meant a six-part crossover.
Wow.
A few issues later, when Captain Marvel Jr. premiered, that was a crossover between Bullet Man and Captain Marvel, that fighting Captain Nazi and one of Bullet Man's villains that introduced Captain Marvel Jr. So they were doing kind of continuity and crossovers in a way that a lot of Golden Age comics weren't at that time.
That's amazing. I think the only reason I even know about the Monster Society of Evil thing is because it got reprinted in like a hardcover edition sometime in like the 60s or 70s, like pretty early on. It's like it's a very early big hardcover, and it's just, it stands out because it's just so unusual that somebody would take the time to reprint an ongoing, you know, serialized chapter, bunch of chapters from an old, from old comics. Like, that was just way before anybody was doing anything like that. I've seen, it comes in like a hardcover slipcase, and like you can get it on eBay, but it's like $500 because.
Oh, I know. I've eyed that thing for like.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
I've actually talked. Kyle Benning, you had on a previous episode, was flirting with going on the public domain sites and like printing it up and kind of putting together like a hardcover himself. And if he does that, I will pay him whatever he wants to put together for me a hardcover of the Monster Society of Evil, because I would just be so happy to have that in like a collected edition.
You hear that, Kyle? Name your price, man. You're ready to do it. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, it's Captain Marvel's just tremendous. And said you could see why DC, you know, gave him this level of attention. I mean, good. He had a TV show. He had a Mego doll. He had merchandise. It was huge. Just a huge, huge thing. So so let's move on to the next story, which is Ibis, the Invincible. The story is supposedly called Ibis Lives Again, but I think all these stories were given titles like after the fact. It's also by Bill Parker and C.C. Beck. A very creative month for these guys. An Egyptian mummy in a museum comes alive and takes the form of the turban-clad Ibis the Invincible. Ibis searches for Princess Taya, his love from 4,000 years ago. Ibis uses his magical Ibis stick to perform a number of good deeds before boarding a boat to Egypt. Taya is revived, but before she can escape the glass box her mummy form was encased in, a crook steals Ibis's wand and takes off. This is an odd strip. I'm not too familiar with Ibis generally. I am a little more than some of the other features just because he is sort of superhero-ish, but it's kind of like this wand could just do anything. So I'm guessing that future stories involved a lot of that, a lot of the Ibis stick being stolen, because if you have him with the Ibis stick, there just isn't much, you know, conflict, because he could just do anything with it.
Yeah, this is, people always say with, you know, magic comic characters that they have trouble getting into them because you can just come up with some magic spell to fix thing. He is that to like the nth degree, because, you know, he points and he says gangplank. He has a gangplank to the boat. He says cease, and a giant bubble surrounds that entire city in his story being attacked. He can basically do anything he wants.
Yeah.
But so I did. This isn't one I necessarily connected with. But to Ibis's credit, he lasted all the way to the end of Wiz Comics. He literally appeared in the final issue in 1953. So he was around a long time. And not only that, but when Fawcett went under in 53, well, not went under, the publishing company was fine, but when they decided to stop publishing comic books, they had some unused inventory, and that included Ibis. It also included Lance O'Casey, who is later in the story. So he survived longer and went to be published. They sold that to Charlton, and Charlton actually published some stories of those characters in the 50s as well. So he had a long history. He lasted 13 years with Fawcett, plus some stories after that. So, you know, that's a pretty impressive run.
Yeah, I'm not sure who owns Ibis anymore, because I know that DC picked him up and he did appear in a few DC comics, but I don't think DC owns the rights to them anymore. So I don't
know. Well, I think he did appear in the Power of Shazam series that Jerry Ordway worked on.
Oh, they did? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Oh, God. I hope I'm not saying this wrong. But I feel pretty sure that he did actually pop up in that one along with his girlfriend. Oh gosh, what was her name?
Taya.
Yeah, I think she actually showed up too. So I actually think he may still be, although copyright is a weird thing, because, like, you know, they can have the rights to publish the current stories, but these older stories can still be public domain and available out there for anybody. So it can get really convoluted. But I do actually think DC may still have the rights, but I'm not going to swear to that. I may be wrong.
I remember at the time of Who's Who, somebody wrote in and said, why aren't you doing listings for all the Fawcett characters. And they said, well, at this time, we're renegotiating with Fawcett the rights to those characters, which is why they're not getting any listings. So Captain Marvel is pretty much the only one. So I guess they've later solved that. If he appeared in Power of Shazam, they must have buttoned that up at some point down the line.
Part of that is actually that in throughout the 60s and 70s, I'm sorry, not 60s, throughout the 70s and 80s, DC was actually only licensing Captain Marvel.
Right.
They did not own him. And a lot of those Fawcett characters they didn't own, so they had to continue to renew the license. And I've never quite been clear on when DC finally bought the bullet and bought those characters, but I did see at least one reference on Wikipedia, and we all know how reliable Wikipedia is, so
right.
You know, take it. But according to one thing I saw on Wikipedia is DC didn't finally bite the bullet and buy these Fawcett characters until 1991, which is hard to believe if you think about Legends and when Roy Thomas did his limited series in the 80s, that they would wait that long. But it would be kind of consistent with, you know, Jerry Ordway doing his Shazam series is maybe the factor. So, again, I don't know how reliable that is, but that's kind of the only date I've been able to see anyone throw out there as to when DC finally did go from licensing the characters to buying them.
Okay.
And, you know, if anyone listening to your episode knows, I'd be thrilled to find out myself exactly when that happened. You know.
Yeah, I like knowing all that stuff. There's two other minor points I want to mention about this Iba story. One is at one point he's crossing the street and there's a woman pushing a baby in a baby carriage crossing the street. And they're about to be hit by a fire truck. Because the fire truck is sort of driving and it's not paying full, I guess, not paying attention. Or the woman's not paying attention to crossing the street. So people are like, they'll be killed. The fire engine can't stop. And the fire engine's like, look out. So he uses his Ibis stick to create a giant hole in the ground, which the fire truck sinks into. Which, of course, rescues the girl and the baby, but probably kills all the firemen. So I don't know if it's the most... He's still new with his powers, I guess. And then later on, he runs into what the caption says, a pathetic sight, which is basically a beaten-up old shack. And living in it is a widow. And so he says, what's the trouble, ma'am? She says, I'm a widow, sir. I've lived in this little house for 30 years, and now they've turned us out. We have no place to go. And Ibis says, don't worry, I'll give you a new house. And using his Ibis stick, he basically refurbishes the house and makes it livable. And they say, God bless you, sir. And he even gives her the deed to the house. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of recall because this is not what superheroes are nowadays. But, like, you know, in the 30s and 40s, Superman, these guys were the champions of the oppressed. You know, these were people suffering from the Depression. And they were the heroes for the little guy. They don't really do that nowadays. But back then, you know, you had superheroes. You know, Superman would take on slumlords. You know, these guys were definitely the heroes of the downtrodden, not the corporate and the wealthy.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me of those stories that story where Superman went after the abusive husband and basically, you know, flew him out and was like, if you do anything else like this, I'll basically drop you from the sky.
Right.
Why? Because, and it makes sense if you have younger audiences that, you know, that's how you think of a kid. You see an injustice. You just, why can't other grown-ups come in and just tell this person, stop this, or we're going to beat you up? And, you know, we don't understand the nuances of due process and the consequences of, you know, those kind of police actions when we're kids. We see it wrong and we don't understand. Why can't someone just fix that and make it better? And in this world of, you know, right after the Great Depression, you know, this poor family is suffering in their, you know, ripped up home and someone wants to take their property to... You know, why can't a magician just come along and say, all right, you know, you have this beautiful home and I fixed it and you have the deed and problem solved.
Yeah. If we only all had Ibis sticks. So the third feature is Golden Arrow, not Green Arrow, Golden Arrow by Bill Parker yet again. This time the art is by Greg Duncan. A chemist develops a new formula that produces a cheap, highly effective gas that can be used as a more efficient energy supply. To test it, he uses it to fill a hot air balloon and take a trip across the world, bringing his family. Out west, an outlaw named Braddock has the balloon shot down so he can steal the formula. The chemist and his wife are killed in the crash, but their infant son survives. The baby is carried away by a mountain lion and then rescued by an old man who raises the boy and teaches him how to survive. The boy shows an aptitude at the bow and arrow, and when the old man dies, he tells his adopted son his true parentage. The boy later finds Braddock, now an old man, and demands the formula. He thwarts Braddock's goons using his arrow and gives the formula to the army, making headlines, and he starts off his career as Golden Arrow. I like the story of this one. It's kind of got like a Tarzan element to it. And yet, you know, he's using the bow and arrow, but it's got some Western stuff, but it's also set in the modern day. My only problem with this one is this, I couldn't cotton to this artwork. I really had it. This is so different from the stuff we've seen by C.C. Beck. And to me, this is just, it's an interesting story. This really kind of, to me, at least done in by the pretty not great artwork.
No, I agree. There are a lot of Golden Arrow stories I've read in the Golden Age that I did like, mostly because of the kind of Western motif to it. Because like you said, it is modern age, but a lot of his stories take place in the West, and there's not a lot of modern technology. It has to do with the ranchers and stuff like that. So they do go out of the way to give it a kind of Western feel, which I like. The art is not strong, you're right. One thing I got a kick out of, though, is how prominent dirigibles are to this story.
Like through this whole comic.
It comes up again in the Spy Smasher. But in this story, the idea that his dad came up in kind of the World War II period with this light gas that was going to revolutionize the industry. And then at the end of this story, he's able to get it back from the guy who killed his father. And there's this hint at the end that, well, now that I have this back, I can, you know, it'll help America in World War II, and it'll, you know, turn the tide of the war to have this light gas to use for dirigibles, which we all know is why we won World War II. If it wasn't for that, you know, we'd all be speaking German now.
Yeah, it's, you know, like I said, I like that he's not a superhero per se. I mean, he doesn't have a costume. He dresses a little fancifully, but he's not a superhero. So it's a nice tonal change from the kind of two more superheroic features. Now, Golden Arrow, he went on for a long time too, right? Similar to Ibis and Captain Marvel?
Yeah, he actually went to the second to last issue of Wiz.
Wow.
Which was 154 in April. Cover date, I think, April 1953. So he had a long run. Now, the weird thing, and this applies to both Ibis and Golden Arrow, is they did have their own self-titled issues, but each one was, well, it's weird. On the one hand, each one only lasted 6 issues, but Ibis's went from 42 to 48, and Golden Arrow's went from 42 to 47. So their release dates were sporadic, would be the only word. I mean, that's kind of how they rolled back then. You never knew, but... So on the one hand, they both only had 6 issues of their title, but they lasted 5 to 8 years, or 5 to 6 years, so that was a long run. But both of them, you know, went on to be through the end of Wiz. So Golden Arrow did have a long life. I should mention that Golden Arrow did come before Green Arrow, but he was not the first Arrow-centric character in comics. There was another character called the Arrow, who was an archer, who was published in 1938, and the company was, I think, Centaur. Was the name of them, and I don't know anything about them, really. But they were the first, and it was a pretty short-lived character. It didn't last very long. Hmm. And then it was Golden Arrow, and Green Arrow came a little bit after. Although I don't really think Green Arrow's whole world and everything was so different that I don't think it was really a copy or...
It's
too different.
Yeah, I mean, a bow and arrow is such a visually appealing hook to give a character, so you'd see why people will come up with that variation, so... the next story is Spy Smasher, probably the other big, you know, in terms of second to Captain Marvel, but probably the biggest name of all these other characters. It's by Bill Parker and C.C. Beck, yet again. Several Navy craft are destroyed over the course of a few days. A Navy admiral is convinced it's the work of spies, and he is right. The man behind all this is a masked saboteur named The Mask, who orders that the next target be the admiral himself, because the admiral is in possession of some top-secret plans. Two of the masked goons try and kill the admiral in the middle of the night, but they are stopped by the mysterious hero known as Spy Smasher. Spy Smasher follows the men in his airship to the mask's hideout. They board a plane and head out over the ocean, where they meet up with the stolen dirigible. Spy Smasher sneaks aboard and beats up Mask's men, taking the controls. The mask sneaks back onto his plane and escapes, but Spy Smasher realizes his first task is to return the top-secret plans stolen from the admiral. Soon, the admiral receives a package from the Spy Smasher talking about, you know, revealing that, you know, the Spy Smasher's out there and he's going to be fighting for justice and he's going to continue to look out for the mask. I don't know what was wrong with me because I've owned this Wiz Comics, Famous First Edition, for, you know, like 35 years. I had it as a kid, and I still have it. The Spy Smasher story, for whatever reason, never did anything for me. But when I reread it for this episode, I really like this. In fact, I really like the Spy Smasher character. I was like, this is a cool strip. I love how it's drawn. I love Bill Parker's artwork. I love that he is drawn mostly in silhouette. He's like Batman in a bunch of panels. And I am totally in love with his super cool airship. The red and yellow airship. Like, I am totally like a Spy Smasher fan now. I don't know what my problem was, but I really like this strip.
You know, until you mentioned him mostly being in silhouette, I never noticed that before, but you're right. You know, on several pages, that's all you see is just a shadowy figure. Yeah. And then when he does go in the light, you never see his face. He's always from behind. That never occurred to me before in all the times I've seen this.
Yeah.
And but it's funny when you said Batman, because one of the things I was going to point out was he was basically Fawcett's equivalent of Batman, because he's a millionaire, kind of, you know, I want to say millionaire playboy, because he does have, you know, a fiance, but he's the millionaire who uses his fortune. He becomes kind of the detective crime fighter. And instead of having a, you know, a spy mobile, spy copter, spy sub, whatever, he has one vehicle, his gyro sub, which serves as combination car, submarine, airplane. But the basic concepts are pretty much the same. And he had a movie serial.
He did, yeah.
Captain Marvel was the first superhero. Not the first. There were comic strip characters, like newspaper comic strip characters that had movie serials first. And then Captain Marvel was the first comic book superhero to have one. And then by Republic. And then Spy Smasher had one shortly after that as well. So he was a pretty big character. And it's funny because it's odd that he was actually one of their big guns during World War II, one of their top characters. But he did kind of run out of steam a lot sooner than the others. He last appeared in Wiz in issue 83 in 1947. And he had one more appearance after that in a self-titled issue of called Crime Smasher. Because he had changed his name after World War II.
Sure.
Yeah, so they changed the name to Crime Smasher. But he had that one issue in 1948, and it was really more of a crime comic, my understanding, that he appeared in part of, and that was the last we saw of him. Although, oddly, in 1966, someone went back and edited his movie serial into a TV movie that aired on television.
Really?
And named it Spy Smasher Returns. So he did have something of a live-action life after that.
Wow.
But one other thing is, for some reason, have no preference either way, but about a year and a half or 2 years after this story, they changed his costume from brown to green. I don't know why, but they did. So if you never noticed seeing him in a green costume, that was a change they did in the Golden Age for some reason.
Now, I love this color scheme here. I love that dirigible. That airship is just so slick looking. Like, oh man, make a toy out of that. That's beautiful. But the one panel, it's on, I don't know if I'm sure, there's no page numbers here, but the one where he helps rescue the admiral, and he chases away the goons. It's just this top panel where he says, a few hours of sleep and he'll be good as new. And he's done entirely in silhouette except for just the two white eyes and his goggles. And I'm like, that's a total Batman look. And I love his name, Spy Smasher. Like, that's a great name. So I'm kind of like, I want to go read some more Spy Smasher comics. Like, this was really, really cool. And I love the final panel talks about, you know, you'll see him in the next action-packed issue of Wiz Comics. And the dirigible is zooming by. It's got a real Flash Gordon-y look. I think this is just terrific. I was really, really thrilled to read this. It was like, it's been here all this time. It's been in this comic I've owned for 35 years and I've never appreciated it. But I'm digging it now. Now I want to go watch the movie serial, too. Because I love the Captain Marvel one.
Oh, the Captain Marvel one, I think, is probably the best one.
Probably, I've seen. Yeah.
And it has been a long time since I watched any of the Spy Smasher one. I've never seen all of it. But what I have seen, I do feel like it's one of the betters. One thing, real quick, if you like the Spy Smasher, I would recommend, it's either issues 15 or 16 of Wiz, is that six-parter starts of Spy Smasher and Captain Marvel. And it's still written by Bill Parker, so it's more a straight story. It doesn't have the humor stuff. But it's a really good story. And basically, Spy Smasher, I don't want to get too far into it, but he is somehow, I can't remember the details, but he's possessed by the bad guys, and he's basically the villain. And part of it is Captain Marvel getting him back to the good side, basically. Okay. So it's a good story, though, so I would check it out.
All right, cool. Very cool. Very, very cool. The next feature is Scoop Smith. by Bill Parker, once again, Bill Parker, man, and Greg Duncan. $350,000 worth of radium is stolen from a hospital. The hospital's president, named John Galt, is frustrated by a lack of progress. A bunch of moochers. He's frustrated by a lack of progress on the case from the police, so he turns to a local newspaper where top reporter Scoop Smith is put on the case. Scoop and his cameraman friend Blimp follows the trail to a doctor who's experimenting with a machine that can bring people back to life. He puts Scoop and Blimp in a death trap to cover up his theft, but they escape and eventually subdue the doctor. His editor offers Scoop a trip to the South Pole where the story of the century is waiting. Yeah, like Golden Arrow, yeah, this one didn't do a whole lot for me, partly because it's just a reporter. The artwork, again, is by Greg Duncan, and to me it's really, really weak. But I like the weirdness of it, that, like, this, you know, this is just like a, you know, this guy's just a newspaper reporter. And he goes and he's, you know, investigating the stolen radium. And you're like, okay, this is a pretty typical story. And then it's a doctor that's experimenting with bringing people back to life. Like, that's a weird zombie element thrown in this sort of regular story. So I like that part of it. And the guy has a death trap. And all, like, he has a trap door in his office, which is really fun. I guess it's like, you know, if your HMO won't pay his bill, he drops you into the pit or something like that. But so, you know, this one was not one of my favorites. But it did have a couple of fun things in it.
There's one thing that drove me nuts about this story, though, at the end. The villain created a life machine that can bring people back from the dead. And the whole point of Scoop's mission is to get this radium back. But during the course of doing that, he discovers this machine that brings people back from the dead. But when he defeats the villain at the end of the story, all he's focused on is, oh, we got the radium back, we succeeded. The whole point of getting the radium was for, like, medical treatment.
Yeah.
If you find a machine that can bring people back to life...
Seems that's like a big story, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm as happy as they would be at the radium if you mentioned to them, oh, yeah, by the way, if you use it in this machine, you can bring people back to life. That's kind of, they'd be pretty happy about that. So that just kind of stuck out to me as a little bit of a, you know, big deal.
One could almost call that a scoop, I would say. this one was kind of like, okay, I'm not sure what this is. But I like the doctor. He kind of looks like Lionel Atwill from all those Universal horror movies. So it's got a horror element to it, and I like that he's got this dungeon in there. That's kind of a dark, creepy element. But the artwork by Greg Duncan, a little hard to take. So no offense, Scoop. Now, did Scoop Smith last a while, or not as much as the other guys?
Scoop Smith and Dan Dare were very short-lived characters, as far as I know. Okay. I never really saw much of them after this.
Okay. Next up is Lance O'Casey by Bill Parker, of course it is, and Bob Kingit. Lance O'Casey, seafaring adventurer, visits a remote island where he finds an old sea captain clinging to life. He tells O'Casey that an American girl and her father were kidnapped by some natives who also looted the village. With the help of his monkey, Mr. Hogan, O'Casey rescues the father and daughter, leaving the head kidnapper, Barracuda Brent, to die at the paws of a man-eating tiger. Other than the names of all these characters, Mr. Hogan, Barracuda Brent, this one, again, did not do much for me, partly because the artwork is even by, you know, the sort of, okay, this is the 40s standards, is pretty rough stuff.
Yeah. This was actually probably my least favorite artwork of the entire series. I thought this was really rough. To their credit, though, Lance, he was another one that went a long time. He went all the way to the very last issue of Wiz, 155 and 53. And not only did he last to the end of Wiz, but he appeared in a lot of Fawcett titles. He appeared in America's Greatest Comics, All Hero Comics, Captain Marvel Adventures, and Master Comics. So, clearly he's a character of the time. Seafaring hero who went around the Pacific. He fought a lot of Japanese characters in, you know, because he was in the Pacific. It was World War II. But yeah, I haven't really connected with many of Lance's stories that I've seen in the Golden Age. I do love that he has Mr. Hogan as pet monkey, but beyond that, you know,
Mr. Hogan gets the last word too. It's the final panel where he's going chit 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 chit. So yeah, big deal for Mr. Hogan. So. Okay, the final story is Dan Dare. This one's actually given a title. It's Seals of Doom. It's by Bill Parker, again, and Greg Duncan. Private Eye Dan Dare receives a telegram asking him to solve a mystery at the estate of a millionaire. He meets with the owner of the estate, who is being implicated in the murder and wants to solve the case so he can clear his name. Dare asks his girlfriend Carol to help on the case, and she flirts with the main suspect, a guy named Portuguese Pete. Little does Carol know, but Pete is on to her, and he and his goons kidnap her, planning to throw her into the oven inside the engine room of Pete's ship. Dan rescues her and in the process learns that Pete is in cahoots with the owner of the estate, who actually did commit the murder to cover up a drug smuggling ring. Both are arrested and Dan receives a telegram about another case. Another one that I was kind of lukewarm on, but it does feature some very strange moments, some kind of really dark things. As I mentioned, when Carol gets kidnapped, they are going to throw her still alive into the oven of an engine room. And there's a panel where she's just laying there, and they're literally going to throw her into this thing where they would, I guess she would slowly roast to death. It's like, whoa, this is some pretty dark stuff, you know? Like, that's kind of remarkable. They just kind of throw that in. And then there's another weird moment where Carol gets a phone call from Dan about going undercover, and out of nowhere is this one panel of not terribly well-drawn art, because it's Greg Duncan, but it's this good girl art where Carol is sitting on a bed in her underwear. And it's just like, what is this doing in this comic book? Like, it's just like very, very strange. So Dan Dare, again, I didn't like it all that much, but it was memorable just for its sheer oddness.
Oh, no, I had the same reaction. Some of the darker moments really stood out for me. But, I mean, it's like I said, the Golden Age had a lot of that. People don't realize, they kind of think, oh, old-timey, it's pure, it's innocent. You know, particularly anything related to Captain Marvel Fawcett. But there were plenty. I mean, even, we didn't mention it, but the Lance O'Casey story, there's that moment where he's cornered the bad guy and the tiger's approaching, and he steps out of the way, and the tiger mauls the villain.
Right.
And they don't get too graphic. You don't see the tiger munching away. But you basically see the tiger's face in his torso with his arms and legs. So you know exactly
right.
It always reminded me, there's one particular Captain Marvel story that always stood out to me. And just to kind of demonstrate kind of the darkness and how casual it was, you know, death could be. He went to a parallel Earth, and there was a parallel Hitler there. Ooh. And that character died. And part of the story was things that would happen on this Earth would eventually happen on ours. So at the end of the story, Billy's at his little microphone talking on the radio, and he's like telling the city about his adventure, Captain Marvel's adventure. And he's like, oh, and that Hitler was killed. So if we're lucky, hopefully in the next few months, that's going to happen in our world. And on the one hand, yeah, it's Hitler, of course. Who cares? We want him gone. But still, to have Billy Batson there hoping that someone's going to be killed, it's a little start, because, you know, even in 2002, you wouldn't have, like, Superman, oh, hopefully Osama bin Laden's going to, you know, die. So it's just a little odd to hear the heroic character praying for the death of someone, even as horrific as that person may actually be. But they just did that. I mean, it was just part of it, and characters died frequently in these stories. And I will say, Dan Dare's story is a little on the darker side between the drugs and the woman being thrown into the furnace. But they did that stuff a lot back then.
Yeah, that really jumped out at me. It really, really did. I was like, wow, that's you know. I mean, you could just knock her out. You don't have to, you know, actually literally roast her alive and the thing, to reduce her into ashes. And then, of course, the whole angle of, like, drug smuggling, that's kind of a novel thing. You didn't really see a lot of that in old comics, the notion of drug smuggling. You know, I mean, that's kind of like a dark thing. So, you know, there was some stuff to Dan Dare. Now, you said he didn't last, he was like Scoop Smith, he didn't last terribly long?
No, as far as I know. The one thing that jumped out at me here is there's actually a British kind of Flash Gordon-y character from
the 50s. Right, the same name, right?
Yeah, who shares the name, who I'm actually a fan of, and I kind of collect reprints and such. And he was published in Britain in the 50s through the 60s, and he's had resurgences over the years. I think Warren Ellis even. He appeared in 2000 AD in the early 80s, and he was later, Warren Ellis did some limited series with him. But just when I hear Dan Dare, my brain immediately goes to that superhero. It doesn't, I mean, I had completely forgotten until I picked up this issue to read that this character was even part of the story, because it just, you know, I don't remember him being in very many Fawcett stories, and he just kind of faded in my memory.
Well, only so many names to go around, I guess. I guess the final thing worth mentioning is this Fawcett is running a contest, which they call the Lucky 7 Cash Contest, where basically all you do is write into Fawcett and tell them which characters are your favorites, and then you get entered in for a drawing to win one of a cash prize. You have to mail it in by January 15th, 1940. So we missed that deadline a little, only by 85 years or 75 years, but okay. One of the things that sort of stood out to me is that it features little headshots of all the characters, and the panel that they use for Spy Smasher is an all silhouette shot. And so you mentioned about they were sort of angling him to be their Batman, and to me you could see that that's what they're doing here. You know, like he's just this dark silhouette as opposed to everybody else, which is all, you know, a full shot of everybody's face and everybody looks cheery. But here he's this, you know, silhouette.
I had previously kind of associated him with Batman just because of the millionaire angle and the vehicles and the costume. But until you've pointed out tonight to me all the silhouettes and the way they've kind of framed him, the panels, I didn't realize how strong it was. But yeah, they're really trying to push that angle with the character.
I wonder if any kids ever, you know, and these kids entered contest, and it's sort of sad to think you're supposed to cut out the coupon and mail it in. So you think about how many, you know, priceless copies of Whiz Comics number 2 were marred just so a kid could win $25. Although, you know, $25 in 1940 was a lot of money. So, you know, that was a pretty good deal. But little.
Oh God, how many comics would that buy you? What, 250?
Yeah, exactly. That's a lot of comics. So yeah, it's the comics back then. They just were constantly asking fans to cut things up and color and things and tear pages out. So that's Whiz Comics number 2. It's, you know, one of the great historic comics of the Golden Age. Now, like, Michael, in your opinion as a treasury, like, do you, I don't think this really gains a lot by being at a large size because, like, a lot of the artwork is pretty crude. Nevertheless, it's nice because DC is paying tribute to one of the great comic book superheroes of all time by simply putting him in this format.
Yeah, I do. I mean, the beauty of the treasuries has always been what it does to the art. And I agree. I mean, Golden Age comics, they don't gain a lot. But it does go back to the fact that this is one of the first instances of really any comic company trying to kind of archive their early editions. So for that reason, yeah, I give it a pat. I can understand why they did it in the treasury. And I do appreciate it for that. But yeah, it doesn't, if you actually sit there and read it, you don't get anything from reading this in a treasury version that you wouldn't get it reading in a normal sized comic. Right. Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, Captain Marvel was a big treasury star. He headlined a bunch of treasury editions for the limited collector's edition series all by himself.
It is weird to think that in a world where, you know, Flash and Green Lantern and, with all due respect, Aquaman didn't get treasuries, that Captain Marvel ended up getting, what, 3 or 4
yep.
Treasury editions? Yep. And I got to think it's due to the TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
At the time.
Yeah. And he co-headlined one with Superman. There's the Superman versus Shazam treasury. So, yeah, he was a big... DC really had 4 big treasury stars. Superman, Batman, Captain Marvel, and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Those were their 4 big stars. They never did a team-up of all 4 of them in the treasury format. That would have been an interesting story to try and write. But, Captain Marvel is a big deal. And, of course, one of them has a photo cover from the TV series, but we can get into that in another episode because that's a great book all by itself. So, Michael, before we sign off, I'm going to ask you, because you're a new guest, I guess the same question I ask of everybody. And the 2 questions are related to treasury editions. One is, what treasury edition of any company do you think should have been done that was never done? And again, the answer I always leave out is Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman deserved her own treasury, and she never really got one the way Captain Marvel did. So we'll take that answer off. But any company, any character, what treasury do you think should have been done that wasn't? And then the second question is, forgetting all commercial considerations aside, what treasury would have you liked to have seen, either vintage or today? If you could see any treasury, what would it be?
Well, for what was not published that I wished had been, and I'm a Marvel fan as much as I'm a DC fan, and it always bugged me when I got into treasuries, because I didn't collect until after treasuries had kind of gone the way of the dodo.
Sure.
And I discovered them later. But I was an X-Men fan, and it always drove me nuts that Marvel never did an X-Men treasury.
Right.
Because by the time I came along to comics, the X-Men was their big gun. Now, I understand why they did not. At the time Treasury started, X-Men was just a reprint title. You know, even they were still going on when they had the resurgence in 75, but as much as that's considered sort of Amazing Comics now, it was a slow burn
right.
to actually become financially popular, you know, mainstream to be one of their top-selling titles. And by the time that happened, Treasuries had probably gone away. So I understand why they didn't do it. But I really wish they had done an X-Men Treasury. And in particular, I think that what would have worked, and I know, and having read them, 60s X-Men comics are not a stellar example of Silver Age comics. But they did have that Neil Adams run with Roy Thomas. And when I think about how Neil Adams' art looked in the DC Treasuries, how amazing that was, I do wish they had at least once done, particularly it could have been a promotion for when they rebooted the X-Men in 75, just done kind of a Treasury collector in some of those Neil Adams X-Men issues. Because it would have been the X-Men Treasury, and you would have had probably the best example of their 60s. You would have had the beautiful Neil Adams artwork there. So that would be one that if I could go back, I wish that they had actually done that they didn't do.
That's a great choice. That's a really great choice.
And gosh, if I could have, you know, whatever I wanted in a person.
It's hard to answer sometimes when you have that many choices.
God, I'm not going to do as much as I wanted to do Jerry Ordway. I know a number of people have done that, so I will stay away from that. But I would do a Marvel DC crossover by John Byrne. Because John Byrne was the very first artist probably that actually sought out his work as a kid and actually went to collect back issues solely based on the art. And in particular, one thing I have in mind is he did a great one-shot of Batman and Captain America.
Oh, it's a great book.
I love that. It's so much fun. It's set in World War II, which is one of the kind of cool hooks for it. And looking at that book, the idea of what his art would look like if he could do a whole Treasury and what kind of cool stories he'd come up with Marvel and DC characters teamed up. And I don't even want to zero on any particular character because it's probably literally dozens, if not hundreds, of combinations of Marvel and DC characters he could do. And he could do either a whole Treasury of one long story that's a team up, or he could do segments with different Marvel and DC characters. I don't care, you know, whatever. But if I could commission my own, and particularly if I could somehow finagle getting a time machine and going back to the 80s and getting like 80s John Byrne to do this, I would be so happy. Just whatever, as long as it's a Marvel and DC book that has John Byrne art all the way through, that would kind of be my ideal Treasury.
That's a great choice. And it's funny you say that because, of course, in the early 2000s, DC and Marvel did team up to do a Superman Fantastic Four Treasury, one of the few that DC did at the time. It was not done by John Byrne. It was done by Art T. Baer, Dan Jurgens, and I forget some of the other people. But, you know, those are two characters that Byrne had long runs on, but not done by Byrne. You know, that would have been a really amazing, like a Fantastic Four Superman Treasury done by John Byrne. Oh, Lord. It would have been unbelievable.
I was thinking about that because I do have that Treasury and I enjoyed it. Yeah. If you went back to like 1986 and got John Byrne to do a Fantastic Four Superman Treasury, it would be a gorgeous book. But it wouldn't even have, I mean, John Byrne, he worked on so many characters and he kind of likes different eras. He could do the Invaders and the JSA. He could do, you know, Hulk and any, you know, Wonder Woman. He could do all these different, and he could either do an entire book of them or he could do different segments and it would just end up being a beautiful book, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. That would be super, super fun. So Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it. I enjoy the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, and I appreciate anybody who has a hankering for these kind of old stories and is out there sort of like reminding people of comics' rich history. So this was really cool to talk about this book. A Famous First Edition is, you know, one of these series I haven't gotten to yet on the show, and I wanted to. And this is a great book. So thank you for reaching out, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I had a great time. And I got to go track down some of the hardcover versions of this. Until I saw your website, I had no idea they even existed.
Yeah, it's strange what's still out there. I'm so amazed that there was just some guy there and had them on a shelf. I was like, we're never going to sell these things. I'll just sell them to this guy for $10. Like, oh, thank God. Where can people find you on the internet?
We just have our podcast that's available on iTunes and Stitcher. We do have a Facebook page for Comics in the Golden Age. We also have our Twitter account, Comics in the GA. And we do have an email account, comicsinthega@gmail.com. Feel free if anyone, you know, listens to the show to write in. And that's pretty much it. I did very recently, I know you're a big fan. I'm a recent sign up to joining the Legion of Super Bloggers. I haven't had a lot on yet. So I know in May I'm going to probably have some of my first stuff start to come out. So, you know, you eventually be able to find me there as well.
Okay. Very exciting. We will be doing a Legion episode of Treasury Cast. I have already talked to a guest about it. So there will be one coming and I will do my best to be as enthusiastic as possible.
So, I'm looking
forward to it. You're looking forward to it? Yeah, well, wait till we get to it. Well, again, Michael, thank you so much for coming on. I really had a lot of fun. It was great to talk to you. Great to, you know, finally get to talk to you. Mike and I were talking about this before we started recording, that it's like, you know, we have a weird relationship with podcasters until you reach out to them, because it's like, I know Michael's voice and he knows my voice from podcasts over the, you know, years now. But we've never actually talked to one another. So it's always a kind of a weird, but then it's great to be like, oh, all right, let's actually connect up and be able to do this together. So this was a lot of fun. Thanks everybody for listening. Hold on and enjoy these podcast promos. And when we come back, we're going to do some listener feedback.
When you talk about comics, does it sound something like this?
Look, you can't put the Superman number 77s with the 200s. They haven't even discovered red kryptonite yet. And you can't put the number 98 with the 300s. Lori Lamaris hasn't even been introduced.
Or maybe it sounds a little more like this.
You think Mighty Mouse could beat up Superman?
What are you, cracked?
Why not? I saw the other day he was carrying 5 elephants in one hand.
Boy, you don't know nothing. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman is a real guy. No way a cartoon could beat up a real guy.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Would be a good fight, though.
Hello, I am the constantly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and my comics discussions can go to both extremes, but generally fall somewhere in between. On the Coffee and Comics podcast, I will review comic stories and other comics-related topics that can be enjoyed over a cup of coffee. So pour the coffee, or other beverage of choice, and join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on iTunes and coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com.
It was 1938. The country continues its slow recovery from the Great Depression. While war clouds loom throughout Asia and German aggression builds in Europe, Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was a time when the most popular form of entertainment was radio. But a new form had been growing steadily and was set to explode. It was to become the golden age of the American comic book.
My name is Chris.
And my name is Mike. Please join us as we explore comics in the golden age between 1938 and 1955. All genres will be discussed, from superheroes to crime, horror, science fiction, humor, and western.
So join us for the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, available through iTunes and Stitcher, and visit us on Facebook or at comicsinthegoldenage.com.
All right, now we're going to do listener feedback, and before we move on to the feedback for episode 12, which featured Ryan talking about the Astonishing Spider-Man, I do want to get one more comment that came in on the previous episode, which was episode 11, Superman and His Incredible Fortress of Solitude, that came in from Diablo Frank. He managed to send this comment in like 10 minutes after I recorded the last section of feedback, so he just missed the cutoff, but I did want to get it in. Frank says, I wish I knew whether I had been into the enormity of Superman lore when I was a kid, but the fact is that Superman stories I was exposed to at the time were all boilerplate super crap with tiled art. I wish I'd had this treasury back then, and you guys have sold me on reading it today. Superman seems so much bigger than anything else in existence based on stories like this, and it's a sharp contrast to how near insignificantly small he's become since Crisis. It makes me sad how DC couldn't figure out how to be themselves in a modern context and settled for being Marvel. I always dug Ross Andrew, and the imagination on display here is pure, rich comic sauce. He also mentions, I remember those little Scholastic catalogs from grade school. I didn't often have money to actually order any books, and I don't recall there ever having comic book-related materials, but I enjoyed tossing through the brochures in class. I really wish I'd at least gotten a subscription to Dynamite or Bananas instead of scavenging the odd issue off a dank rack at the back of a Woolworths, also one of the few places treasury editions could be found. Yeah, Frank is absolutely right about Woolworths. I bought quite a number of treasuries from Woolworths. In fact, those were where we used to go when my dad and I would go to his office on weekends when he had to like work on an occasional Saturday. We would go to Woolworths and he would buy me a bunch of treasuries and put me at his secretary's desk, and that's what I would spend the afternoon reading. So yeah, thank you very much, Frank. Thanks for the comment. I'm glad I managed to get it in. Anyway, we're going to move on to, as I said, to episode 12, which was The Astonishing Spider-Man with our pal Ryan Daly. Alan W. Wright says, I owned one of the other Marvel team-up treasuries, Sensational Spider-Man, Marvel Treasury number 22. I didn't own the treasury you cover, but a friend of mine did. Back in 1980, I had just been introduced to the X-Men in Uncanny X-Men 138. It was Jean Grey's funeral, and Cyclops helped his new reader by recapping the team's history. I was amazed by this elaborate and detailed corner of the Marvel Universe that I had previously been completely unfamiliar with. I asked my friend Rob, not Kelly, if he knew of these great X-Men characters, and he pulled out his copy of this treasury. I remember thinking the X-Men story was strange and that the characters came off as jerks. That's a great story, Alan. Thank you. I don't know why they come off as jerks exactly. I think they're just sort of doing, I guess because they're going after Spider-Man. We all know that Spider-Man's our hero. So, our pal David Ace Gutierrez writes in to say, worth it for the pics. Thank you, David. I do love those photos of me reading treasuries as a kid. He says, and any Band on Their Own reference has my attention. What the hell, Ryan? Besmirching the terrific Nicholas Hammond by comparing him to Tucker Carlson? I have to admit, I thought that was a little below the belt on Ryan's part. Our pal Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog writes in. He says, like Ryan, I love the original Mar-Vell costume. That color combo and design are striking. The second outfit definitely looked better on Carol Danvers because of those black-blue shorts were definitely of the bikini variety. Did you notice that he's a friend from work joke has made its way into the Thor Ragnarok trailers? Yes, Martin, because that's exactly where I got it from, actually. And he says, I've never seen this treasure. Sounds like a fun collection. I looked up that Band on the Run cover. Clever stuff. Thank you, Martin. Thank you very much for the comment. Yeah, I love that. I didn't know that till many years later that that was a gag on that cover. J. Kevin Carrier says, excellent episode. I would not have rated this treasury as one of my favorites, but hearing you guys talk about it made me appreciate it more. That cover is a stunner for sure. I'm glad to hear I'm not the only one who was traumatized as a kid by the Orb's messed up face. Man, that was gross. So true, Kevin. So true. Dr. Ange, Comic Box Commentary Blog, says, I don't have this treasury, but I have a couple of the issues within. I consider team-up books to be a gateway drug to expanded universes. So Marvel Team-Up was one of the few Marvel books that I collected semi-regularly in my youth. I was more in the Claremont Byrne time period, but I would buy any of these I saw at yard sales. The Iron Fistbone was incomprehensible to me now and then. And isn't there a panel where it's implied Drum's mother gives birth to an adult? Disturbing. But I had to comment because I'm occasionally gobsmacked at the collective mind of this community. Often before listening to a podcast, I'll look at the gallery post. Now, I am a Gwen guy, but when I saw the page of MJ standing in front of the Ghost Rider poster, I thought, man, that image captures everything Mary Jane is. Who gives a crap about the Shocker robbing a fur coat store when you could hang with her? I then listened to the show and laughed out loud when the two of you waxed poetic about that very splash. And the orb reveal is classic. Do you have a reveal moment like that haunted you as a kid? As a little kid, I caught a rerun of Quincy where he was dealing with a plastic surgeon who botched surgeries. Jane Greer, appears under a veil the whole show until the end when in court she reveals her scarred face. Terrified me as a kid. I don't remember that episode, Ange. I used to watch that show. That does sound pretty scary. But yeah, the orb thing always stuck with me. Speaking of that, our pal Chris Franklin from the network comes in. He's Supermates Pod, the new show, Superman Movie Minute, and Nightcast, of course. He writes in to say, what a great episode. Definitely flew the Find Your Joy mantra of the network from beginning to end. Good on you guys. Confession time. This is the first treasury I ever owned. I begged my mom to buy it for me at the Eastside Pharmacy, see the FW Presents on newsstands. It looked a little scary, but it was Spider-Man and my three-year-old self wanted it. Turns out it was a bit too much for me. The book scared the bejesus out of me. I think it was the orb's reveal that sealed the deal. I was so scared of it, I asked my mother to throw it away. Yes, I requested my mother to serve in that stereotypical function of the crusher of childhood dreams and throw the book away. That's fantastic, Chris. Oh, my God. So then our pal Ryan Daly comes back in and he chimes in. He says, so, Chris, as a child, you were terrified by Darth Vader and Mr. Chance about Star Wars in the theater. And now you were scared of the orb and begged your mom to throw away the Astonishing Spider-Man treasury comic. I'm on edge to find out what's next. So then Chris retorts, well, Vader didn't scare me so much as my parents were afraid I would be scared. But there always was the Wolfman, which is now my favorite Universal monster. His transformation in Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein scared me into actual hysterics when I was 4 or so. In fact, had I seen that first, the sheer sight of Werewolf by Night on this cover would have been enough to send me crying to Mama. I was a big wiener. Oh, I love these stories of Chris as a child. And he also has one other comment regarding the school book fairs that we talked about in the previous show. He says, since last episode, Danny's school had their spring book fair. There were several of the Marvel manga-sized books there, a Cap Civil War tie-in, Rocket Raccoon and Groot, etc., and the first new Marvel Star Wars trade paperback. So there was no reason the Marvel treasuries couldn't be at these book fairs. Absolutely, Chris. We gotta talk to you about that. Mark C. writes in to say, I'm fairly certain this was the first Marvel comic my dad ever got me, probably because I was a huge fan of Spider-Man and his amazing friends, and there's Spidey and Iceman on the cover. I never really made that connection, Mark, but you're absolutely right. He says, one of two things that have always stuck with me all these years later is the X-Men story. Being introduced to Cyclops, Jean, and Angel wearing street clothes added to the trilogy's overall mystique of a weird, evil underworld that existed in the MU after the sun goes down. And these guys were the ones here to protect us. This story, combined with another early Marvel read for me, Secret Wars, where the X-Men deliberately separate themselves from the main heroes to become a third faction, cemented the idea that the team were the oddball misfits of the Marvel Universe. I like to think that in another reality, street clothes X-Men was the premise of a cult 70s TV show. The other thing that struck with me from this trilogy was, of course, the orb's face. Yeah, I like all that idea. The X-Men in plainclothes does have a real kind of 70s cop show feel to it, like almost like a Night Stalker kind of thing. I dig that. I'd like to live in that world where maybe Netflix makes that show. Thank you, Mark. And then Ciscoid from our network comes in Lonely Hearts and Invasion Podcast and Ohatmu, of course. He comes in and says, I love team-up books, and if you are fans too, watch the network for a special announcement from the Canadian-US border soon. Yes, I can second that emotion. Thank you, Ciscoid. Twitter-wise, I want to thank these people who retweeted and liked the show's post over on Twitter. But first, I want to thank Bold Outlaw, which is at Bold Outlaw. He sent a scan from a later issue of Marvel Team-Up where they addressed this whole thing about why the X-Men were in plainclothes. Because a letter writer came in, wrote a letter, Brian Howard from West Virginia, and he basically asked, why are the X-Men not in their costumes? And the answer is thus. Awesome explanation department. It's like this, Brian. The X-Men were moving around so helter-skelter that it was highly unlikely anyone would even notice their faces. After all, if a guy with wings was standing next to you, what would you stare at? Also, the X's were changing costumes so often toward the end of their run in their original mag, and since they're still decked out in their first set of Zoot suits in the reprints, we figured it would confuse just about everybody, especially us, if we showed them in uniform, okay? So much for another look behind the scenes at Marvel's enigmatic editorial expertise. So it was basically sort of like a no-prize-y thing that they came up with the reason why the X-Men are in plainclothes. But thank you so much, Bold Outlaw, for sending that in. That's a great catch. So, and like I said, I want to thank these people for retweeting and liking the show over on Twitter. Really appreciate it. Rolled Spine, Firestorm Fan, Supermates Pod, Twitter _ Parker, DSNRS, Ciscoid, Static Keeling, Comic Reflection, Creator Talks Pod, Warlord Worlds, Citizen Varum, Tsujo, Longbox Crusade, Kyle Benningart, McGee Gorgo, M.W. Cronenberg, Comics in the Golden Age, which of course is Michael Lane, who appeared in this very episode, John D. Null, Mrs. Peppermint, Mr. 70, ASM Super Spidey, Greckel, Jimbo 32, Movie Mad Matt, Ranting Demon, Mark Lax 1, Jensen 64 Cent, Danny Slacks 1, BTO and Bat Books, Creator Bull Outlaw, once again, Gatto Andalus, Fanholes Podcast, Max Overmero, and The Toy Room. So thanks, everybody, for retweeting and liking the show on Twitter. That's how we get the word out. We didn't have any iTunes reviews this time, I guess, so please go on iTunes and leave positive reviews for the show. It will help the show get noticed. Not that there's a lot of other treasury casts out there, but the more positive reviews we have, the better. So thanks, everybody, for the feedback. I really appreciate it. And thanks to Michael Lane for coming on this episode to talk about the famous first edition Wiz Comics number 2. That was a whole lot of fun. So I guess that's going to do it for this episode. Of course, you can remember this to find all this and our previous episodes of the show over on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can check the gallery post for scans from this comic. So I guess that's going to do it. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
Mighty grateful.
That's all right, Jack.
You know me?
I ought to. I'm your twin brother.
Alan! Well, I thought you were killing that plane crash in France a year ago.
So did everyone. Even the news service I reported for. That's why I became Spy Smasher, so I could fight the Nazis on their own ground. Now it's time to fight them here, in the United States.